These chairs are so cute.
The Judiciary Committee will come to order. The chair recognizes a quorum. And for the record, CA, I think I just broke my little block right here, so we're going to need another one. Jeez. Budget cuts. Okay. Representative Johnson moves approval of the minutes of January 15th, 2019, since I know he looked at them most closely. All in favor of minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion passes. And, oh, wait, I forgot to ask for discussion, but I'm sure one of you would have piped up if there was. So the motion prevails. The minutes for January 15th are approved. So, members, first thing we're going to do here is we're going to do introductions. Since we did not do introductions yesterday, because I had to leave early to go down to fight City Hall, so I'm sure you all read about that. So we'll begin... And ideally, just say something about your district, name where you're from, what term this is for you, and if you have something that you would like to see out of this committee, this legislative session, maybe sound off on that. I will start. My name is John Lesh. I serve District 66B, and that is the Como Park, Midway, Hamlin Midway, North End, and East Side areas of St. Paul. This is my ninth term in the legislature, and I have been on public safety, which is a portion of this previous committee in its previous incarnation for 12 years before they moved it to coincide with taxes. So who wants to go next? Representative Zhang.
Right. My name is Jay Song. This is my first term. I am from District 67B, Battle Creek, Mounts Park, Highwood Hills, Dayton's Bluff, Beavers Lake area. Looking forward to working with all of you.
Excellent. Thank you. Mr. Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jack Considine. I represent 19B. This is my third term. 19B is about 90% of the city of Mankato and the small town of Eagle Lake and one township, Mankato Township. This is my first time on judicial. I have served on the Public Safety Committee on my first two terms. Looking forward to working with the chair.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative Noor.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Mahmoud Noor. I'm representing District 60B, that is Minneapolis. So this is my first term, and I look forward to learning a lot and addressing some of the disparity issues that we have in our system.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andrew Carlson, District 50B, which is all in Bloomington, Minnesota. So second term on this committee, so looking forward to working with you all once again.
Thank you, Representative Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kali Herr, and I represent 64A. Those are the areas of Summit Hill, Merriam Park, Mack Groveland, Hamlin Midway, and St. Anthony Park are just a few of them. I still have to write them down so I remember them all. I am a first-termer, and I'm really excited to be working with all of you in this committee.
Thank you, Representative Herr. Representative Cantrell.
My name is Representative Hunter Cantrell, proudly serving the communities of Savage in the northwest portion of Burnsville. I'm in my first term, and I am excited to work with all of you and especially our chairman on ensuring that that the laws that we pass in this legislature and that go before this committee intersect appropriately with the constitutional mandate of this legislature. So I'm looking forward to the work that we're going to do.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am Kelly Moeller, and I represent District 42A in the northern suburbs, so Shoreview, Moundsview, Arden Hills, and a little bit of Spring Lake Park. I am actually a former classmate of the chairs at Hamlin University School of Law, and I am thrilled to be here today and on this committee as your vice chair, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I'm happy to have you, too. Pipers represent Hamlin 98. That's right. It's the Hamlin Pipers. The reason for that is because the Pied Piper was from Hamelon, okay, which isn't the same. But in case you're all wondering why the mascot is the Pipers. We're not going, we introduced, I know you're wondering about that, Representative Considine. We introduced our CA and our CLA yesterday, and we're going to save the best for last, our research. See, we've got the full complement of the Brain Trust over here. We're going to save them for last. Oh, and we got to come around to this side, too. Representative Hassan.
My name is Hoden Hassan. I represent South Minneapolis, and I am excited to be here. I was told this is the fun committee, so that's why I'm here.
Yeah, there you go. Fun.
Mr. Hayter?
My name is Robert Hayter. I am the DFL caucus researcher for this committee, the Public Safety Committee, and the Corrections Subcommittee.
Thank you. And why don't we start on this side, Representative John? Oh, yeah, I guess we can do Representative. You want to go ahead, Representative Leland?
Your call, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
All right. Well, good morning, everyone. Tina Liebling from Rochester. I'm in my eighth term. I think that's one term less than the chair. And as you may know, this year my head is mostly going to be in Health and Human Services. But here I am, and I used to be a criminal defense lawyer. And I usually agree with the chair on stuff, but not always. But I am one of those people in this legislature who often says, go John Lesh. So I'm actually excited to be on this committee for that reason.
It's a distinct and august yet small group. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Representative Brian Johnson, 32A, which is most of Isani County and northern Chisago County. I'm on my fourth term. I've always been on the public safety and judiciary, whether they've been split or not. Last session was the first time I had not been on civil law, so it's good to be back in the civil law committee. I am a firm believer that every legislature should spend at least one session in the civil law committee to actually understand Chapter 13.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Representative Marion O'Neill. I have 29B, which is Buffalo, Monticello, Maple Lake. I'm also in my fourth term. We came in together. And I've been on the Public Safety Committee since I was first elected. And I did serve two bienniums on the Civil Law Committee. And I'm really glad to be on this committee with you, Chair Lesh, because you and I have done some really good work together, and I hope to continue that. You know, we've got some great things on the books now because of work we did together. So excellent. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Robbins?
Good morning, Chair and members. I'm Kristen Robbins. I represent House District 34A, which is half of Maple Grove, Rogers, and Dayton. And I'm a freshman, and I have a lot to learn, but I look forward to learning from all of you.
And you're the new Joyce Pepin, is that right?
I am, yes.
All right.
Big shoes to fill.
Well, she was good. She was fantastic to work with. And I think, was she your class also, Representative?
Yes.
She was, yeah.
Very so, august class.
It is, yeah. And Representative Barr.
Mr. Chair, members, Cal Barr, District 31B, which is North Anoka County. This is my second term in the legislature and first term on this committee.
Representative Robin, I'm sorry, Representative Grossel.
Representative Matt Grossel, District 2A, and it covers from the northwest angle, which also has our last functioning one-room school, which we got some building funds for last biennium, which give the kids a good place to go to school. And then also all the way down to Akeley. So it's a couple hundred miles long and probably about a 70 miles wide district. It comes with four counties. And I look forward to working in civil law. I'm also on public safety and our vets committee as well.
Thank you, Representative Grossel. And Chair Scott.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peggy Scott, I represent Andover, Northern Coon Rapids, and one precinct in the city of Ramsey. I'm in my sixth term. And the thing that I would like to see our committee work on, and I know it's not everybody's favorite subject, is some family law stuff. I'd love to see equal shared parenting passed. Thank you.
Thank you. And your researcher.
Callie Lehman, I'm the House Republican Caucus researcher.
Ms. Lehman, I know who you are, but you changed your hair color, and I can't tell who you are from the back. So I said just the researcher for now, but thank you. And Representative Scott, you and I have worked very well together in the past, and I'll very much look forward to working with you again this legislative session to do a lot of good work. And members, for those of you who don't know, typically in the Public Safety Judiciary Committee, we have had a lot of bipartisan legislation come out of here. There haven't been a lot of huge fights. I'm sure we'll fight about guns, maybe a couple other things, but for the most part, one of the things I like about being on this committee is the divisions come down sometimes on things other than party designation, which makes it a little bit more interesting than the typical two-dimensional argument around here. So I hope we can continue that tradition and make it a little bit more three-dimensional. And with our researchers, please introduce yourself, starting with Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, Nathan Hopkins with the Nonpartisan House Research Department. I work on civil law issues and government data practices.
Thank you. Ms. Mullen?
Chair and members, my name is Mary Mullen. I also work in the House Research Department, and I do civil law, family law, human rights law, real estate, and landlord-tenant, and things like that.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair and members, Ben Johnson with House Research. I'll staff the judiciary issues here. I'm also staffing the Public Safety Committee. Mr. Chair, I believe Representative Lucero arrived.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the heads up on that. Representative Lucero, we're just saying who we are, where we're from, and if you got any hopey, dreamy kind of stuff for the committee this year.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being a few minutes late. As I walked in, I thought we were talking about how good this committee is and how fantastic the chair was. But
keep going.
I am... Eric Lucero. I serve the great cities of Albertville, St. Michael, Otsego, Hanover, and the Wright County portion of Dayton. I'm in my third term. This will be my second term on this committee, and it's great because, as you just alluded to, it is not a hyper-partisan committee, and there's a lot of overlap in terms of what we can agree on in the areas of civil law and privacy and the topics that this committee covers. So I'm looking forward to this session.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Lucero. I don't think there's anyone I missed. Representative Carlos Mariani also serves on this committee, and he is the chair of the Public Safety Committee. He and I will be working pretty closely together because there is substantial overlap. And as members are aware, in the Senate, they just have one committee. And I do recall, because of the history of us having split committees in the House, of the difficulty in dealing with the Senate on conference committee. And so often and on occasion, the various public safety, civil law, judiciary committees have had issues that we've had to resolve with each other before we go face the Senate, since they're unified. So we're going to try to do that again this year. And I remember having those frustrations, whether I was in the majority or the minority, because I had my provisions as a minority member in majority bills, too. So I did want to make sure that we introduced our pages. Today we have Jorge. You want to introduce yourself, Jorge?
I'm Jorge. This is my third session here. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. And the of the family of our distinct chief clerk as well. So I introduced him on the floor when I nominated his dad. And we have Emily Anderson. Emily, will you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Emily, and this is my first time being a page, so my first session.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks for being here. The rules, member, the rules have been updated with the correct room number, and they are in your files. With that, we are going to move to our judicial overview. Now, before Mr. Shorba begins, and Mr. Shorba is the state court administrator, he wants to, or he is the person who's going to be the liaison, really, for our courts throughout the state. And behind him is Janet Marshall, who is the lobbyist. Is that your title, Ms. Marshall?
Liaison.
Oh, you're liaison. Okay. Well, this is the administrator, Mr. Shorba. And I want to remind you that when we do department overviews, members, they're doing overviews of departments that we have throughout the state that are administered by the executive branch, nearly all of them, really, with the exception of the legislative auditor, et cetera. The courts are their own branch of government, okay? And they have to show up at the legislative branch in order to get their funding, but there's this weird kind of thing, and there's kind of a wink and a nod, because we can't necessarily treat them just like another departmental agency, because they have a function that is co-equal to ours. So the relationship with the courts is a little bit different, and I hope we can keep that in mind as we take a look at what they're doing with their budget. With that, Mr. Shorba, please introduce yourself and tell us who you represent.
Good. Thank you so much for those comments, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Jeff Shorba. I am the State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch, and I'm very happy to be here today to present to the committee an overview of Minnesota's third branch of government. There are three things I hope to accomplish today with my time with you. The first is to provide an overview of the branch structure, how we operate. Secondly, highlight some of our recent re-engineering efforts, ways that we are trying to improve the way we do our work for our court customers and to be more effective and efficient. And then highlight some efforts of some of our unique court customers that we are trying to change the way we do business to make sure that they are being supported within the judicial branch. The judicial branch's mission is clear: to provide justice through a system that assures equal access for the fair and timely resolution of cases and controversies. We take every word in this mission as being very important, but particularly fair and timely. And I'm going to talk a little bit later on about how we measure our performance in these areas to make sure that we are living up to this mission. The work of the Minnesota courts is a core government function addressed in Article 1 of the Minnesota Constitution. The Constitution guarantees that all Minnesotans are entitled to obtain justice without purchase, completely and without denial, promptly and without delay. Every Minnesotan is entitled to a remedy in both criminal and civil cases in the state of Minnesota under our Constitution. A little bit about the branch from a high level. We have 319 judges and approximately 2,500 employees. We handle about 1.3 million cases a year in 106 locations across the state, with a budget given to us by the legislature of $692 million. Interestingly, the judicial branch operates geographically in more areas of the state of Minnesota than any other part of state government. We are funded solely from the state general fund, and this budget funds the judges, staff, and operations for all the trial courts, the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, the State Law Library, and the State Court Administrator's Office. As you can see from the bottom footnote here, the judicial branch has also allocated funds for civil legal service programs. For fiscal year 18 and 19, that amount was $27.4 million. It really operates as a pass-through grant program. Legal aid operations throughout the state apply through money for money, and we allocate out that money to them that is given to us from the legislature. Minnesota has a streamlined three-tier structure of two appellate courts and a single trial court called the District Court. The Court of Appeals was created via constitutional amendment in 1983 to help deal with the large number of appeals in the trial courts. The Supreme Court has seven members who hear cases as a group. The Court of Appeals has 19 members who hear cases in three-judge panels. And then the trial court has 293 judges. So we're a little different from other states. In other states you may travel to, you'll see specialized courts at the trial court level, juvenile courts, probate courts, justice of the peace courts. We have one level of trial court here in Minnesota since 1987. I'll talk a little bit in more detail about each of the levels of courts. The seven-member Supreme Court hears appeals, or what they call petitions, for further review from the Court of Appeals, the Tax Court, and the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. In addition, the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, which means that cases go directly to the Supreme Court, which involve first-degree murder, legislative and election contests, and judicial and attorney discipline. So in 2017, just to give you some idea, there were 635 petitions for further review to the Supreme Court, people who wanted to have their cases heard before the Supreme Court. Of those 635 petitions, 12% were granted to be heard, and there were 108 direct appeals from those original actions I just outlined here to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, in addition to hearing cases, has the responsibility for the regulation of the practice of law, and they do that through various boards. These boards are not funded through state appropriations. They are funded through attorney registration fees, but they help the Supreme Court regulate the practice of law. The largest one is the Lawyers Professional Responsibility Board, and their job is to oversee and administer attorney discipline, so any complaints against attorneys would go to this board. The Client Security Fund was established by the Supreme Court to reimburse clients who suffer losses of money or other property from the dishonest conduct of attorneys. So they receive grant opportunities for people to be reimbursed and will use money from their funds to do that. The Board of Law Examiners, of course, administers the process to license attorneys who practice law in Minnesota. They conduct background checks. They administer the bar examination. The Board of Continuing Legal Education oversees the rules of continuing legal education, so attorneys are required to get 45 credits every 3 years, and they administer that process and make sure courses are accredited to have attorneys go and get those CLE credits. And then the Board of Legal Certification, lastly, is a board that looks at attorneys who want to have a designation as specializing in a certain type of field, and they administer those special certifications for attorneys to use and call themselves experts or specialists in various areas of law. So these five boards are what the Supreme Court uses to carry out that responsibility to regulate the practice of law in Minnesota. The Court of Appeals hears appeals from trial court decisions, of course, administrative agency decisions, and the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development, or Unemployment Compensation Appeals. They have original jurisdiction to also hear writs of mandamus or prohibition, which are requests for the Court of Appeals to compel either a court or a public agency to do some particular action or to be prohibited from some particular action. As you can see from the slide, in 2017, there were 1,973 cases filed at the Court of Appeals level. And then, of course, our largest operation, the trial courts, 293 judges who hear cases in various case types, as you can see from the screen. They also are responsible for conciliation court civil disputes up to an amount of $15,000, which can be filed in that court. I want to talk in a little bit more detail about the trial court, since it is our largest court operation, and I think it'd be helpful for the committee to know a little bit about what our caseload is like at the trial court level. In terms of workload, it's important to note that judges spend 82% of their time on what we call major case types. So included under the major case types would be felonies, gross misdemeanors, contract cases, personal injury, malpractice, property damage, employment, among others. Minor cases would include conciliation court, which I just talked about, unlawful detainers, implied consent, default judgments, minor DWI, traffic, and parking kinds of cases. So most of the time are spent on the ones which make sense that take a little bit more time because they're more complex.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question for you.
Yep.
And I've never asked this question in the decades that I've practiced, but I'm wondering why, when we have the obvious demarcation between felonies and gross misdemeanors, misdemeanors, and petty misdemeanors, why a gross misdemeanor is a major case type? And I understand that requires a formal complaint, et cetera. But how did the gross misdemeanor fall into kind of felony land in terms of how it's viewed as a major case type?
I think it's, Mr. Chair, I think it's sort of exactly what you just said. It's taking a little bit more time versus the categories for the others because it is a more formal process. And so we put it in the major case type because of the time it takes for judges to be more involved in these kinds of cases. The people could debate about the demarcation between the two, but it really was a timing issue that we're looking at.
Okay. I do recall someone who had sat on this committee, I think, long before I was born, mentioned that back in the day, the only gross misdemeanor that existed was bear baiting or something, I think, in the 70s. And then all of a sudden, there were all these gross misdemeanors floating around, so which we, of course, create a lot of those around here since they don't require a fiscal note. And it's a popular way to increase penalties without legislative consequence. Anyway, thank you. Mm-hmm. Please continue.
Sure. So if we look at the breakdown of major case types, as you can see, the criminal cases are the largest category, largest percentage, followed by family and juvenile. Juvenile would include cases like children in need of protection, permanency, delinquency, and those kinds of case types. And I'll talk a little bit on this next slide about where we're seeing that growth. Over the last 5 years, the judicial branch has seen an increase in the number of major case filings and an increase in the complexity of the cases brought to the trial courts. The most marked increase is in children in need of protection or services or CHIPS cases with a 42% increase. As you are probably very aware, there have been a lot of resources at the county level put into handling these cases, and we are seeing that increase now in the court system. Permanency cases, an increase of 69%, and then felony and gross misdemeanor increases, especially those with drug possession, 36%, domestic assault, 24%, and DWI, 23%. So these are the cases where we are seeing the largest growth going on in the court system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question on the drug possession. Is there what's the cutoff amount of possession of drugs between a misdemeanor and a gross misdemeanor?
Mr. Shorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I'd have to get you that information. It's going to vary on the type of drug. Mm-hmm. And we are seeing various epidemics, some places more opiate increases, some places meth is strongly back, but I can certainly get you those breakdowns because it varies by drug.
Thank you.
Yep.
For marijuana, it's 1.5 ounces is the misdemeanor, unless you're, you know, well, that's a petty. Unless you're in a car, it's a misdemeanor, and then above that, it goes straight to felony. There's no gross. So 44 grams or whatever, but for all the other ones, it's yeah, it varies based on drug.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Shore.
So our trial courts operate in all counties, but are organized into 10 judicial districts for administrative purposes, and these districts also serve as the election district for judges. So as you can see from the map, we have two large single county districts, the second in Ramsey County and the fourth in Hennepin. The other eight are multi-county districts ranging from four counties in the 6th district to the largest district, which is the 9th district, with 17 counties, and as you can see, it covers nearly a quarter of the state. These 10 judicial districts were established by statute in 1959, so they have been around for a while now. So with regard to election, justices and judges are elected to office for a 6-year term. The Supreme Court and Court of Appeals judges are elected statewide, and district court judges are elected from the judicial district in which they serve. If there is a midterm vacancy, those vacancies are filled by the governor, and by statute, the governor must use a judicial selection commission to screen district court judgeships. Often governors will also use that commission to screen Court of Appeals and Supreme Court applicants. If you have a complaint against judges, those are filed with the Board on Judicial Standards, which is a 10-member board appointed by the governor. That board may issue private discipline or a public reprimand against a judge or recommend that an action be taken by the Supreme Court. Only the Supreme Court can remove a judge from office. Administratively, the Chief Justice, by statute, is the administrative head of the judicial branch and responsible for its overall management. As you may know, in 2005, when we transitioned to full state funding of the court system, we also instituted a new administrative structure called the Judicial Council. I'll talk a little bit more about it in a minute, but the State Court Administrator's Office, my office, serves as staff to the Judicial Council, and we provide administrative support across the state in a wide variety of infrastructure areas. The Chief Justice, of course, leads the Supreme Court, which continues to have that authority to regulate the practice of law and also to issue rules for the procedures that are followed before all courts of the state. There's a chief judge of the Court of Appeals who is appointed by the governor to a three-year term. And then there's a chief judge in each district elected by their peers on the bench for a two-year term, and they're responsible for the management of the district alongside a district administrator and county court administrators. So unlike other states at the county level, for example, if you go to Wisconsin, each of those county court clerks are elected. We used to have that system until we changed the Constitution here, and they're now appointed by the bench. We have 87 counties. We have 50 county court administrators because many of those court administrators are able to serve and oversee more than one, especially small counties. So we've created some efficiency there by changing that structure. The Judicial Council is the administrative policy-making body for the branch. It's comprised of 25 members, 19 judges who serve as voting members, and 6 administrators. The Chief Justice serves as the chair, and a vice chair is elected by the members to assist the chair. This is really our body responsible for statewide administrative policy making. They put together our two-year strategic plan to guide the work of the branch. They're responsible for deciding what kind of legislative agenda, including budget requests, we're going to have before the legislature. Once the legislature gives us funding, they allocate that across the state. And then they are also responsible for monitoring our performance, which I want to touch on next.
Mr. Jorban?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So of the 25 or the 19 judge voting members, you got one chief from each of the 10 districts.
Correct.
And I'm assuming representatives from the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court. How many of those and who are the other 9?
Sure. So the judges that are on the council are, as you mentioned, the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals and the districts and the Chief Justice. There's one Associate Justice from the Supreme Court selected by the Chief Justice. Then there are 5 at-large judges, 3 of whom have to be trial court judges who are also chosen by the Chief Justice. So the way that the council was formed is that the voting members, the majority of them would be trial court judges since that's the largest part of the branch, and so I think right now 6 of the 9 are trial court judges.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The goals for the Judicial Council to monitor include the ones you see on the screen. We have each of these goals because we want to ensure that we have an accountable judiciary, that we are improving operations of the court system, and, of course, enhancing the public's trust and confidence in our judiciary. So the way we measure those are by multiple things. First of all, we have an annual performance measures compliance report, which details our progress towards meeting each of these goals. It's published and posted on the Judicial Branch public website. It includes 3 tools to demonstrate compliance with our goals. One is an access and fairness survey that we do of attorneys and other customers who come into the court system. We do it every 4 years. We're in the process right now of surveying our court customers. We started that survey process in 2018 in November, and it'll continue through March of 2019. So if you come into the courthouse and you are a litigant or you are an attorney, you'll be asked if you want to fill out a survey about your interaction with the court. If you have any online experience with us or by telephone, we'll also ask you to fill that out, and the Judicial Council then looks at those results and sees ways that we could improve our service to the customers. We also do a survey of our judges and staff employees throughout the branch. Again, we try to do that every 4 years to see how we're doing with our own judges and customers, and then we also bring those results back to the Judicial Council. We have significant amount of timing statistics looking at how long it takes to dispose of cases, how long cases are pending, the length of time to adoption and permanency and other things, and those are contained in that report I mentioned on our public website. And then we do an annual report to the community on how well we're doing with our strategic plan. We're putting that one together right now for 2018, and it should be out sometime towards the end of February, again posted on our website. So we take performance measures very seriously in the branch and spend a lot of time at the council looking at how we're performing and trying to improve. So that tells you a little bit about the structure of the court. Now I want to highlight some of our reengineering efforts in the court system. 2 years ago, when I appeared before our funding division, I reported that the judicial branch had just completed the largest transformation in the 150-year history of the judicial branch. This multi-year transformational effort replaced paper-based court files with an electronic information environment at both the trial and appellate court levels. We believe it has resulted in more convenient online service to those we serve, while also aiming to make our operations more efficient. So I want to describe just a few things that have become available since we transitioned to an e-court environment. First, court customers are now able to instantly and securely file and serve court documents electronically from their home or office. Customers no longer have to worry about courthouse business hours. They can file and review documents 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The public now has expanded access to court records, including the ability to access public court documents via public terminals in all 87 counties, and to a limited basis through our judicial branch public website. We are hoping to expand remote access in the next year even further. Law enforcement, county attorneys, public defenders, and other government partners have an electronic portal where they can instantly access court documents and records that they are using. And of course, on the bench and in our courthouses, judges and court staff have new electronic tools to help them manage and process electronic court documents. Our appellate courts also transitioned to the paperless world pursuant to a Supreme Court order effective July 1st, 2016, that documents to our appellate courts also had to be e-filing. So just to give you some scope of this electronic document use, we're averaging more than 260,000 documents being e-filed each month into our case management system, and 45,000 each month into our appellate case management system. So to think that just a few short years ago, these 1.75 million documents were put into file folders, handled every day with paper, and only accessible at a specific courthouse are significant changes since we started this process in 2012. Some other reengineering efforts. Go ahead.
So I think it's been a remarkable transformation in watching a judge from the bench on, say, a probation violation hearing, who would normally send a defendant back to return because that judge had to review a case that was in front of a different judge or those findings or something, can instantaneously pull it up on their big screen at the bench and make a decision on the spot. So you clearly did training for judges on that, too, because I think a good share of them are Luddites and don't know how to do the technology, but they figured out how to do it somehow. Okay, so I was very impressed with that, and I think it just saves a lot of time of court staff, attorneys, and defendants of not having to set an entire time to come back because the judge can do that. I would note, though, that as a private attorney, when I'm able to log in to court, you know, Minsis or something, I can't get access to those filed documents unless I go to the courthouse, and it becomes a really big pain in the rear. So a rising tide doesn't necessarily lift all boats, and I would encourage you to make it available to everyone because there are some disparities that occur and assumptions that happen among people who have access that inure to the detriment of those folks who don't. Thank you. Please go ahead.
So let me just comment briefly on that, Mr. Chair. You're absolutely right. It took a lot of training. We developed particular software for our judges to use on the bench called Benchworks that helps them to navigate the case management system. And we're very proud of the progress they've made in being able to do those things from the bench. As I mentioned earlier, we are working on a new remote access system so that not only private attorneys but also members of the public could have access to documents 24/7. We're in the testing stage with that with our case management vendor and crossing our fingers that we'll have something soon, so I appreciate your comments on that. Some other reengineering efforts. After we completed our transition to eCourt, we began having conversations about how we could leverage this new technology for a number of reasons. One is our customers are demanding it. Many do not want to have to travel to a courthouse, sometimes pay for parking to come to handle some of their matters or look at documents. We're also seeing changes that are happening in the demographics of Minnesota, more urbanization, less people in some of our parts of greater Minnesota. And so we wanted to try to help with that situation because in 2017, many of our rural courthouses had fewer than two full-time staff, making it difficult to keep those courthouses open during business hours. So to tackle that problem, the Judicial Council worked on a plan to centralize some of our work in some of our greater Minnesota communities. So, for example, summoning jurors and processing those summons are now handled in the 9th Judicial District, which has allowed for them to have staff on site, at least two people in each courthouse. Processing of child support orders is now done in the 8th Judicial District. We have expanded or expedited those cases and have been able to reduce the processing time by 20% by having specialized staff do it. And we now have all appeals going to the Court of Appeals, taking the district court record and putting it in a form to send up to the Court of Appeals is now done by staff in the 5th Judicial District, which has, again, allowed us to keep those courthouses open. We are also looking at specialization in other areas to try to do our work more efficiently. Just recently, we launched what we're calling the Conservator Account Review Program. These are specialized staff who will be looking at conservator accounts under $10,000 to try to put that information together for our judges in a more usable form. Some of these accounts can be very tricky, a lot of numbers, a lot of accounting, and having specialized staff doing them, we believe, is going to help protect our vulnerable adults. We have specialized staff now processing our administrative judgments. So these would be like default judgments, transcript judgments, restitution judgments. And by having specialized people do them, we believe we'll be able to be more accurate and also to process them more quickly. And finally, we have adopted more mandatory court process policies to try to make sure that our courts are being more consistent across the state and that we are having better data reporting and data collection. So these are all being developed in my office and are now mandatory ways that court staff have to enter information into our court management system. Lastly, I want to talk about some of our unique populations of customers and what we're trying to do to help them in various areas. As you all know, the demographics of Minnesota is changing. By next year in 2020, the state demographer tells us that we'll have more people in Minnesota over the age of 65 than we have going to kindergarten. So our vulnerable populations are increasing, whether they be the elderly or others. And so in 2012, we launched the Conservator Account Auditing Program. It's really a nation-leading initiative to protect the assets of vulnerable individuals for whom the court has been appointed a conservator. Through CAP, we have modernized the way the state oversees the work of conservators. Before CAP, conservator records were submitted to court on paper, frequently accompanied by boxes of receipts and other documentation, and it put a heavy burden on local district staff responsible for overseeing the work of these conservators. Now they must submit information electronically through an online reporting system, which has built-in red flags, which will help us to address if there are discrepancies in how these accounts are being managed. The program includes a centralized team of professional accountants who are looking at these accounts to see if there are discrepancies. We are monitoring today in Minnesota assets of 5,575 vulnerable individuals with assets totaling more than $908 million. So it's a huge undertaking. We have already seen results since 2012. In nearly 12% of the cases under the program, auditors have found concerns of loss or commingling of funds, and we have promptly been able to hold hearings on these cases, either resulting in discharge of auditors, judgment and orders for repayments, and in some cases, criminal prosecution and conviction. So we believe this program, which has won numerous national awards and has been replicated in many other states, is one that is really helping this population. Self-represented litigant services. One of the biggest challenges in the court system is the increasing number of self-represented litigants. As the number of people choosing to represent themselves in court proceedings continues to grow, Minnesota has become a nationally recognized leader in providing services to these self-represented litigants. Number of ways we're doing that, the Minnesota Statewide Self-Help Center provides assistance to these individuals online through help topics on our public website, and one-on-one help provided for free, both over the phone and through email. In 2018, we provided one-on-one support to over 28,000 Minnesotans via email and phone who visited our website and asked for help in their cases. At more than 100 courthouse locations across the state, if you go to one of our courthouses, you will see that we have installed self-help workstations, which consist of a desk, a computer, and a phone that can be used to help find court information, print court forms, or talk on the phone with staff in our self-help center about processes. In addition, we have expanded in the 2nd, 4th, and 10th judicial districts our use of walk-in self-help centers, where they can provide court users with extensive information on using the court system. We also, in the 10th district, now have weekly walk-in sessions in each of the counties in the 10th, where self-help staff were set up time. For example, I was just in Wright County, Sherburne County the other day, and it was Wednesday, and it was family court day, and so there were people waiting at the law library to talk to somebody for help in their family court cases. This has helped the judges refer people to these clinics. We also have an appellate clinic at the State Law Library where people can get help with their appellate cases. It's held monthly, and it offers volunteer attorney time to help with their appellate cases. And then lastly, if you go on our website, you'll see that we have a very extensive forms library, which we are trying to expand on every day. Many of our newer forms now, fillable forms, where you'll be asked a question about your case, you answer the question, and it tells the form how to fill it out so that you don't have to fill it out yourself. You just follow through on the question. So I think we're doing a lot for this growing population that is coming before our court system. The Court Payment Center is our centralized virtual payment center for paying citations that are processed centrally rather than having the work done across 87 counties. When we started this initiative, we had 111 FTEs across 87 counties working on payable citations. We now have 29 staff across the state working on this because we have centralized it. We process about 1 million citations a year, traffic, DNR tickets, and ordinance violations. We have a small office in Wilmer handles all the actual money that is processed. Again, the Court Payment Center has been recognized with numerous national awards. And again, I talk about it often with other state courts looking to do the same. Limited English proficiency. The Court Interpreter Program supports our goal of helping people who cannot speak English or who are deaf or hard of hearing. On average, there are 27 court events each year that require the services of a court interpreter. Last year, there were 99 different languages for which a court interpreter was requested. You can see on the slide the 5 most common languages right now, and that tends to vary depending on how our demographics vary within Minnesota. We are doing our best to try to handle this growing need. A couple different ways. We are now setting up a new interpreter scheduling system where we're going to have more centralized scheduling, and we think that will help also make use of about the 10 staff interpreters that we have as employees of the branch. We also are trying to implement more remote interpreting. Our biggest cost is interpreters having to travel to events. Most of our most qualified interpreters are located in the metro area, but some of our greatest need is in greater Minnesota, so the travel costs are extensive. So we're setting up new technology in our courthouses so that some of these cases, not obviously jury trials or anything like that, small appearances can be done via remote interpreting. And then the last special area I want to talk about is treatment courts. Over the past several years, Minnesota has experienced a significant expansion of treatment court programs. Today, we have treatment courts operating across the state, and I'll talk a minute about what kinds of categories those are. These are really specialized calendars within our trial courts, which represent a shift in the way cases are handled with certain offenders. Working better with key stakeholders in the justice system, in this approach, we work closely with prosecutors, public defenders, probation officers, social workers, and other partners to develop a strategy that we believe will help an offender into completing a treatment program and abstaining from repeating the behaviors that bring them back to court over and over again. It involves investing a little bit more time up front, a little bit more time with our judges, interacting with the individual offenders. But the long-term outcome on the back end has been very positive. Treatment courts across the country, but particularly here in Minnesota, have been studied over and over again and have consistently shown that they reduce recidivism for those who successfully graduate from one of our treatment court programs. This map just gives you a visual of where we have treatment courts across the state. We have the brown states on the slide, which are not currently serving those counties with treatment courts. The rest are either existing treatment courts in the blue or planned treatment courts. They currently cover over 70% of the state. They're operating in 66 counties with four in the planning stages. Right now we have 61 treatment courts. You can see from the slide that they vary. I could certainly talk about any one of them in detail if you'd like, but drug courts are our largest, followed by DWI courts addressing alcohol addiction issues. Hybrid courts means it considers both drug issues and alcohol issues. We have mental health courts in St. Louis County, Ramsey County, and Hennepin County. Family dependency court is a docket which handles abuse, neglect, and dependency cases. We have seven veterans courts right now to promote and assist veterans across the state. And then we have two tribal courts operating on the White Earth Reservation, and those are handling both adult and juvenile issues. We'll be talking with you later about our budget request, which will contain some greater information on treatment courts.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to put a plug in for the treatment courts. I was the legislator that expanded them across the state and funded them. And before I did that, I actually went and toured them. And so I went to seven treatment courts in Hennepin County, three in Ramsey, and a couple others in other jurisdictions. And it's like nothing else I've ever seen. It's just an amazing collaboration of everyone that could possibly have an input into that person's life are there at the table. It's really impactful. And I know we just had a conversation before the committee started, and I'm going to be going to, I think it's the third or fourth that I've attended of graduations in Wright County. And so they've got a great treatment court there as well. Had some bumps along the way, as they all do, but by and large, they really, really do impact people's lives and change it for the better.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill, and thank you for your service in doing that as well, too. It took a lot of effort on your part to reach where we are now. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Shorb, I just I think that's great. I'm a big supporter of that, too. And I just also want to say, before I ask my question, that I'm very impressed with the strategy of specializing some of the services, because we all know that we have workforce shortages across everywhere. So probably besides having people who know what they're doing in each of these areas, you're kind of probably making the best use of the limited staff that you're going to be able to find. So I think that's a great, great thing. My question relating to the treatment courts is kind of twofold. One, I know you're going to have a budget request, but can you just give us a quick snapshot of how those things are funded? I mean, are there different funding streams that are coming in? I mean, I'm doing HHS finance. I'm, like, interested. Are there just, you know, is this out of this court budget, or is there different things? And then secondly, whether we have sort of ongoing evaluations of how effective these are.
Mr. Chorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, let me just talk a little bit about funding. So there are various funding streams for these courts. Mental health courts, for example, are funded by DHS. The DWI courts are funded by the Office of Traffic Safety through federal money that they get. We have a funding formula. Last time we were here for a budget, we asked for some money to stabilize our funding formula for those courts that are funded out of the general fund or the state court budget. And so a number of courts are funded out of there. When they are funded out of our budget, we do require a 30% match from the local jurisdiction that can be either in-kind or dollars. So many will provide probation, office support, and other kinds of things like that. And then many of the courts start with federal funding. The federal government has increased the amount of funding that they are providing for these courts because they see that they work. And so we do have courts that apply for federal funding. One of the things we'll be bringing forward to you with our budget request is federal funding ends. And we have five courts right now who are working very well, who will be losing federal funding, and we'd like to put them into our funding formula with some additional funds. As far as performance evaluations, we have done two evaluations of courts here in Minnesota, and I can certainly give the committee, when I talk about our funding request, more detail on that and talk about the recidivism, but we are constantly evaluating them, not only here on the state level, but on the national level. And then lastly, you're preaching to the choir on demographics. We are having a tough time finding workers, especially competing with other public sector entities. So it is one reason why we're really looking at the way we do business and changing it so that we can be as efficient as possible, because even if we wanted to, we may not be able to keep the levels that we have right now in our court system. So thanks for that question.
Other questions while we're at it? Okay. Please proceed, Mr. Schorber.
So that concludes my presentation, my overview of the court system. I hope that you'll take a couple key things from the presentation. One is that we believe we are being good stewards with the public money that you give us in the court system. We are constantly looking at ways to change the way we are doing business and to become more efficient and more effective, but also constantly keeping in mind what do our customers want and how can we give them better access to our court system. You've already heard about some of the improved efficiencies that we've done, a national model in many areas. And then we consistently want to work with our justice partners to make sure that it's not only the court system, but the whole justice system that we're making stronger. So I am happy to answer any questions, any further questions about the court system. Before I take any further questions, I just want to put in a little advertising plug. We're having an open house tomorrow at 1 o'clock in the state capitol courtroom. Hopefully you've all received an invitation. Come and see the beautiful courtroom if you haven't seen it yet in our state capitol, but also meet members of our judicial council and our Supreme Court, who will be there to answer any questions you have of them about our court system. So thank you very much.
Thank you for the thorough presentation, Mr. Schorber. We'll have questions for you from the committee. I have one question. And members, this is one of those areas that gets confusing because it blends in with the jurisdictional area of Chair Mariani's committee, but remind me how we fund corrections. Do we still have three corrections systems? I'm talking community corrections, Department of Corrections. How do we fund them?
Mr. Chair, I used to work for the Department of Corrections a while ago, but we do still have three funding systems that are funded differently throughout the state. We believe that some of the work we're doing, especially in the treatment court area, is creating efficiencies for the correction system in terms of jail time or bedtime in corrections. But the funding that we have, none of that comes from their system, but we still do have three systems funding corrections in the state.
So Ramsey County Corrections, mm-hmm. How are they funded?
So I believe that some of the money is county money, but they also get money from the state through a formula. It's a formula for each of the funding systems. So the state ones that are operated are fully state-funded. The rest are funded, I believe, and you'd have to, it's been a while since I've been there, but a blend of county money as well as state money that's given through a grant program.
Well, I'm assuming they may testify in an overview in Chair Mariani's committee when that comes. The reason I ask is obviously that has a big impact on our effectiveness for the courts, and I recall during those years of budget cuts when we were imposing fees, which weren't a tax, okay, they were a fee, just to be clear, inside joke. But one was out of the blue, unilateral $300 probationary fee that got imposed. And I thought, how did this happen? And corrections kind of imposed it. Unilaterally, they were getting budget cuts, so nobody blinked. I get it, but it really impacts the justice system when all of a sudden that's another thing that happens to a litigant or a defendant in the court system. And there are many of us litigators in the criminal area who have been amazed over the years at the outsourcing of judicial decision-making to corrections. It's saying, well, I don't know whether I'll agree to that or not. You're going to have to check with corrections. something that I consider absolutely to be a judicial function. That's where you wear the robe. That's why you get paid the big bucks. Well, you guys can talk to us whether it's big bucks or not. But it's a concern of mine. It has been a concern of mine. And you don't have to answer the question now, but it's an area that blends through both. So,
well,
more of a rhetorical question.
No, Mr. Chair, I won't answer about the judge behavior. That'll be somebody else who can answer that at some point. But, I mean, fees continue to be an issue. We believe it's an access to justice issue. As you mentioned, there was historical times when budget cuts were looming that fees were increased. Luckily, during the last budget session, we were able to reduce some fees, and we hope that there may be some appetite to do some of that as well, but they are certainly a concern.
Thank you. Questions for members? Oh, Representative Mueller.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Sherba, thanks for being here today. I just had a question about accessibility of electronic information, and what does your staff do to ensure that private or protected information is not being viewed by the public, whether that's for a victim survivor or defendant?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Sherba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, the accessibility is dictated by the Rules of Public Access, which is a Supreme Court committee that issues the rules and tells our staff how to classify data. So we have three broad categories: public data, confidential data, and sealed data. And we are constantly working with our staff to make sure that those classifications are followed. The Rules of Public Access Committee will be meeting again come March or April to further discuss how we can hopefully simplify some of those rules. I will say this is another centralization effort that we have done just recently in the branch. We can continually monitor whether or not our documents are being classified correctly. And recently we began specializing staff to do document acceptance. So now in each of our districts, there are staff who spend at least 50% of their time classifying documents that come in from the litigants or the public or in court to make sure that they do it regularly so that they are becoming more efficient and accurate at it. So it's another effort we just started about a year ago.
Okay, thank you.
Questions from other members?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Chris Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's maybe worth noting right now, since the data issue was brought up, that for the new people on the committee and the new people to the legislature, that the courts are not subject to Chapter 13. They have their own set of classifying data. So,
thanks for pointing that out. And, you know, I would note, though, that this committee does designate data sets which are public and private by other agencies, and other agencies draw from those court records. So there's also this cross-branch issue that we can have from time to time, which appeared most recently in the expungement issue. The courts had always been willing to expunge records for good reason, but the BCA, which is a executive branch agency, already had them and weren't expunging them. So it's a good area for you to pay attention to, Representative Mueller, because it's super complicated. I mean, you can't do it with a flow chart. Good luck. Other questions? There being no other questions, I would note, members, that this is not going to be the only time that we hear from Mr. Sherba. The courts, they will be presenting their budget in future weeks. And we look forward to hearing from you again. Thank you very much, Mr. Sherba.
Thank you.
That being the case, we are supposed to adjourn at what, 11? 11:15. Okay, good. Well, see, I'm going to release you early, and you can bank that time for future committees when we go along. Any other questions for members of the committee? There being nothing else, committee is adjourned. Thank you.